You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is I'm Ready for My Close-Up. On tonight's show, I'm talking to comics writer and artist Brian Talbot about his career from doing underground comics in the 1970s up to his current and epic graphic novel Alice in Sunderland. Later in the show, I'll be talking to Mark Wright, who adapted Brian's comic serial The Adventures of Luther Arkwright to the audio medium and is currently hard at work adapting the sequel. First up, here's Brian in an interview that I recorded at the Bristol Comics Expo, so you'll have to allow for the background noise. Your current project that you're touring the UK with at the moment is Alice in Sunderland. It's an epic 320-page book about the influence that Sunderland has had on culture, art, literature, in particular Alice in Wonderland, but also throughout the world. I mean, how did that start in the beginning?
I think it's really, actually, it's more about storytelling when you get down to basics. It's about stories and myth and history and sort of how these myths are formed, you know, how the stories are formed. But yeah, I've been wanting to do something on the theme of Alice for about 20 years. And then I moved to Sunderland, basically because my wife got a job teaching at the university there. And I can work anywhere, so I ended up moving there. I didn't really want to go, you know, I was quite happy in Preston. But I arrived in Sunderland and discovered that it had all these links, not just with Lewis Carroll, but also with Alice Liddell's family, his supposed muse for his inspiration for the character. And both families had extensive links to the area. And in fact, you know, Jabberwocky, most famous nonsense poem in the English language, was actually written in Sunderland.
The scale of the project, taking everything from Shakespeare to Sid James, and you go through a variety of art styles as well, from your sort of like, you know, regular, more sort of calligraphic style to also the use of sort of photoshopped images. Was it just you felt that this was a British history project that needed telling? It seems to follow in the tradition of sort of Alan Moore's research or something like From Hell, but even more so because it's about an area rather than a particular story.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, the setting for the story is the Sunderland Empire, which is fantastic Edwardian palace of varieties. So I thought pretty early on it had to be like a variety performance, so that's why each story that I tell is told in a style that I think is appropriate to that sort of story. You know, the story of Jack Crawford, Sunderland hero, the sailor, you know, the guy who gave the phrase to the English language, the Nailed Your Colours to the Mast. I mean, his story, it reads like, you know, boys on adventure story. So it had to be told in a boys on adventure style. The ghost story, The Cold Lad of Hilton, I thought had to be told in a 1950s horror comic pastiche, and so on. I just told all different things in a different and appropriate style. All the Lewis Carroll sections are sort of sepia watercolour.
I've spoken to a few comic artists over the weekend, and they said that when they work with different writers or for different companies, they sometimes get asked, could you do this in a certain style? I mean, with this project, you were your own boss. So was it also an opportunity for you to work in different styles that you hadn't done previously and had been itching to have a go at?
I suppose so. It was quite fun in that way. You know, I mean, there's one two-page sequence that was really fun to do, which was set in Morocco. And it's somebody put me in mind of the crab with the golden claws, you know. So I did those two pages in Hergé style. And I even got the lettering done by Starkings Fonts to resemble the Tintin lettering, you know.
The kind of projects you've done in the past have varied immensely from tale about child abuse in The Tale of One Bad Rat, Victorian science fiction in Nemesis the Warlock and Luther Arkwright. Is it that you're happy working in various genres, or is there a type of storytelling that appeals to you in particular?
I think it's more that I get, by the time I finish one graphic novel, it usually takes me at least 2 or 3 years. Alice took about 4 or 5 actually, but by the time I finish one graphic novel, I want to do the next one I want to do. I want to be making something completely different. Otherwise, I just get bored.
Luther Arkwright, you've done 2 volumes of it so far. I mean, it's an epic time-travelling parallel universe story. But I'm thinking he's a character that first started out when you were doing indie comics back in the 70s. And then would you feel the urge to flesh out his story into sci-fi epic?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what happened. I worked for the first 5 years in underground comics. And one of the issues of Brainstorm Comics was an anthology. And I just did this Luther Arkwright 8-page strip as an excuse to do a strip in line and wash, ink line and watercolour wash. And I based the character very strongly on Michael Moorcock's Jerry Cornelius character. And Mike Moorcock actually created Cordiness as a template anyway, and he said that other artists can use it, you know. But after I finished that, I then started thinking, well, I can perhaps take it further, take it away from the Jerry Cornelius sort of character, give him his own character, and I started getting ideas for this big, you know, the big long adventure story. And I was brought up in Wigan in Lancashire, which has a lot of the local histories to do with the Civil War. So I set it on a parallel where the Civil War is still going on and there's still a descendant of Oliver Cromwell as like the dictator of Britain. And, you know, over the years it's become like a fascist Puritan dictatorship, you know. And the royalists in the story are the terrorists.
It's the first comic strip that Big Finish adapted as an audio version. Did you have any say in the adaptation? I mean, presumably, because it's audio only rather than the original book, which relies heavily on pictures, they had to change the storytelling to a certain extent to accommodate the fact that it's voice only.
That's right. I mean, I thought that they stuck too closely to the book. I think they could have, you know, changed a bit more to adapt to an audio drama. But on the whole, I thought it was great. David Tennant was great, as Luther Arkwright. And this year they're supposed to be making the sequel. They're supposed to be making Heart of Empire.
I mean, it's ironic in looking back on it that he was playing a time traveller who has a companion called Rose.
Rose, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Arkwright, you've also been serialising on the internet. Is it you feel that the comics should be more available in the digital domain? Looking at how comics are probably accessed in the future, I think Scott McCloud has sort of talked about this to a certain extent. Do you see the day coming when people will have like comics on PDAs and mobile phones?
I don't know. I still prefer the comic as an artifact, something you hold in your hand. You know, it's a nice, nice thing to have. I don't know if you've seen the Alice book.
Yeah.
But that's a nice sort of tome. You know, it sort of weighs nearly 2 kilos. Got gold lettering on the front. You know, I mean, it's a nice sort of book to hold, and you can't really get that with computers. But yeah, I think the internet is going to be used more and more for comics. You know, that's why we got the Arkwright book up there as a web comic.
At the other end of the scale, to go along with the release of Alice in Sunderland, you've got an exhibition of the artwork at the Cartoon Museum in London. How important do you feel that it is that comic book artists can be accepted in a gallery environment as much as other people who do illustration and painting?
Yeah, I think it's quite important because, I mean, to a large extent, comics is still perceived by a lot of people as like the bottom of the artistic barrel, you know. So any... you know, any public exposure like that, any sort of hint of respectability is always sort of welcome, I think. I mean, it says a lot that, you know, Jonathan Cape are publishing Alice, and it's been covered extensively by all the, you know, a lot of the mainstream newspapers. Now, that wouldn't have happened if it had been a comic publisher. It would have been ignored if it had come out from a comic publisher, but because a respectable publisher is doing it, then it gets all this sort of media attention. But I think it's very important, because, you know, the graphic novel sales are growing and growing. They've been described as the fastest growing area of book marketing in the last 100 years. And, you know, 10 years ago you hardly had any graphic novel sections in libraries or bookstores, and now you do. It's I think it's becoming more and more accepted as a legitimate medium.
Well, because people have been combining text and images for hundreds of years. I mean, you know, if you want to stretch the metaphor, I mean, going back to Egyptian times with the use of pictograms as a language. Yeah. I mean, I'm just surprised that it's taken this long for the mainstream media or sort of educational environments to accept it as, you know, a legitimate medium.
Yeah, well, following the first comics, which were aimed at an adult audience, things like Alice Loper, you know, Victorian comics, it quickly soon became sort of accepted by the publishers that this was a medium that children could enjoy reading. Because they saw children reading these comics for adults. So then they started producing comics for children.
Yeah.
And very quickly, all comics were for children. And so now we still have this perception in our minds, or other people do, that comics are children's medium. I mean, you could have said the same thing about animation in the 60s. It was still perceived as a medium just for children, but now there's animated films. You know, I've seen feminist animated films, you know, adult animated films. It's now more or less accepted, I think, that... anybody can join a good animated movie.
And when you started off in the underground comic scene in the 70s, did you think that you'd ever be able to make a career of it?
I didn't know. I think that's when I started to think I may be able to. All the time I was growing up, I was reading comics, everything, and even drawing them for my own amusement, but it never occurred to me I could make a living doing it. And when I finished college, I was unemployed, and I thought I might as well you know, this idea for a comic I had. But this was a time when underground comics were quite popular, you know, and quite big. And after I'd done about two or three of them, I started thinking, well, perhaps I can make a living doing this. You know? And it's 30 years later, I'm still doing it.
Actually, it's funny, when I started reading comics myself, things like 2000 AD, it was actually your run on Nemesis that actually got me into character. But coming before you, people like Kev O'Neill and Redondo had sort of stamped their mark on the character. How do you feel as an artist when you sort of take on other people's characters and sort of pass the baton to sort of develop in your own style?
Yeah, I think it's important when you do that not to just try and copy what's been done before. Just go ahead, do it in your own style, you know, and make it your own.
Victorian sci-fi seems to be a sort of a subgenre that you're associated with, and you do very well. There was the whole the techno series of comics in the mid 90s, and you're heavily involved with Neil Gaiman's Technophage. What was it like working on that?
That was quite a fun story, written by Rick Veitch, who did quite an outrageous sort of very fast moving story. It was just fun to do because all I was doing was the pencils. It was being inked by Angus Mackay, so it was quite a quick job for me. But yeah, and apparently I'm one of the fathers of steampunk. You know, if you look in the Wikipedia definition of steampunk, and there's a list of people who helped create the genre, I'm one of them.
Cool. You've been doing quite an extensive tour along with Alice. I mean, is that because of Jonathan Cape plugging the book, or the fact that there are comic fans all over the UK, that this gives you an opportunity to kind of meet with your audience and sort of interact with them?
Yeah, it's nice getting the feedback, but no, it came from me, the tour. I mean, when Bad Rat came out, I did a tour. When Outright came out, I did a tour. I think it's important, you know, when I get a book, I've spent years doing it, just promote it as much as I can. So, yeah, I think getting out and meeting people, selling copies is a good thing to do.
It seemed to be a good turnout for the opening night at the Cartoon Museum. Mm. It was good to see Paul Gambaccini giving you a glowing introduction.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering, what kind of feedback do you get from your peers? I mean, about the kind of work you're doing and the projects you're working on? Because I see that you're doing a book next about interaction with other comic book creators at conventions and other locations.
Yeah, that's it, but it's not a comic, it's a prose book. Right. It's about 40,000 word prose book telling sort of all sorts of outrageous stories about comic creators, so I'll probably get sued when that comes out, I think. Although I do use the word allegedly quite a lot in the stories. And also make a point that these outrageous stories are... they're not necessarily true, but it is true that they're actually told. Mm. The idea being that the sort of stories that get told late at night in the pro bar when everybody's had a few drinks, you know.
And then after that, you're doing a new comic called Cherubs?
Yeah, that comes out the same month. That comes out in June. I've just written that. It's a four-parter miniseries, like a supernatural comedy adventure story. It's being drawn by Mark Stafford, who's probably the hottest British indie artist, I think, at the moment. He's got a fantastic style. And his artwork for Cherubs is absolutely stunning.
And after that, what other projects can we expect from you?
I have a proposal and some sample visuals for a graphic novel I have with about six publishers at the moment. So I'm still waiting to hear if any of them bite. You'd think it'd be easy after 30 years to get a publisher, you know, if you snap your fingers and they'd roll up. But no, it's always like pulling teeth trying to get a publisher, you know.
Are there any other epic tales like Alice in Sunderland that you feel you have in you? Or is just that the sheer scale of that project, you think that's like kind of a one-in-a-lifetime?
I won't do something as research-heavy as that again. Although this steampunk novel, this next one I want to do, it's going to be set in sort of a retro SF version of La Belle Epoque, you know, Fin de siècle Paris. Mm. So I've already started collecting books on Paris with old photographs of the city and stuff like that. But yeah, what I actually want to do, I'm also slowly working on a sequel, another Luther Outright book that I want to do at some point.
Cool. Well, I mean, I suppose if he is based loosely on Moorcock's The Eternal Champion, then you don't necessarily ever have to kill him off, he can keep going.
Well, I don't know, there's only one of him, though. Yeah. He's not like The Eternal Champion, but there's only one of Luther. In fact, you know, he might well die in the end of the next one, I don't know.
Cool, all right, thanks a lot.
Okay, cheers.
Induction tape KN23A. Subject Arkwright L. Recorded 14/12/1970. Personnel present: Wild R. Ashinko K. Extract 7/16.
When I first headed for Tibet, I theorized that it was logical. Where better to hide than the remote vastness of the Himalayas? As I drew nearer, though, I knew that I was being drawn there by a powerful psychic summons.
Extract 723.
The lamasery, for as much as it appeared to me, it shimmered like a mirage. It assumed solidity as I approached. Perhaps it was never really there. Through the gateway, the climate became tropical. Impossibly beautiful flowers and shrubs flourished as if in full bloom. The five awaited me. I'd seen them before, in a vision before my escape, communicating by thought transference. I was expected.
You've just heard David Tennant performing a diary entry from the dramatised version of The Adventures of Luther Arkwright, and next I'm talking to Mark Wright, who turned Brian Talbot's text and drawings into narration and dialogue. Was Luther Arkwright the first writing gig you did for Big Finish, or had you done the Doctor Who plays first?
I'd done two Doctor Who's for Big Finish at that point, and I was in the process of writing a Tomorrow People. Mm. Jason Haygathery, who's the Big Cheese at Big Finish, he approached me, I think it was India Fisher's birthday party, and said, "Oh, your Doctor Who's were all right. Do you fancy doing Luther Arkwright? I've just got the rights to it from Brian Talbot. It's one of my favourite graphic novels of all time, but, you know, I was wondering if you want to do the adaptation." And kind of my jaw dropped. And my initial reaction was to run away screaming, thinking it couldn't possibly be done. Mm. I just, knowing, you know, it's a bit of a, for me, a sacred cow is Luther Arkwright in kind of in comic terms, because it's so good and so influential in British comics.
Yeah.
And then you start thinking about the story and the things that Brian does in it and achieves in it, and the visual representations are just so rich. Mm. You think, how could this possibly translate onto audio? And then Jason said, "Well, just go away and have a think about it, and maybe, you know, maybe dust it off and read it again." And so I kind of did, and after I read it for the first time in a couple of years, again, I wanted to say no, just thinking impossible. And then I read it again and again. And it kind of, I realised that there were three very distinct parts to it. I mean, although the, you know, it was released in kind of single issues, over the 12 issues, I think it was, but in the kind of the collected form, I noticed that there were three. The kind of the first chunk, which is the first disc of the audio, is all exposition and setup and about, you know, kind of quite esoteric themes about Luther Arkwright. And then, once he gets into the story and his mission and he meets Harry, we've got almost an easier narrative kind of story to achieve. And then we have another kind of different story. We go off in a different direction where Luther becomes the assassin, and then he goes... So it kind of then realised that you could break it down into this kind of three-act structure, and that made me realise that, yeah, maybe we could do this.
Okay. It's a different direction for Big Finish, in the sense they'd done the 2000 AD plays, but they were new stories with comic book characters. Well, this was actually an adaptation of an existing book. So it must have been, challenging in the way that you're relying on someone else's words, but you have to make them work in a different format.
Absolutely, and I think that was the scary thing, because I don't think when I did the adaptation I quite had the confidence to go in my own direction. And I'd had no contact with Brian. I actually met Brian at the Bristol Comic Expo the weekend that the first day in studio was being recorded. I wasn't there, I was at the expo. And so I met Brian, I said, "Hi, I'm doing the..." He went, "Oh, I tried to get some messages through to you via Jason about what I thought you could maybe do." "Oh, Shane, never mind." And then, I mean, I've heard kind of recently that Brian likes the adaptation, but he did think that it could have gone, it was too faithful in a way. And I absolutely agree with him. I mean, I think if I'd had more confidence back then, had the experience in adapting, I would have taken my own route on certain things, which I'm kind of, you know, once bitten, twice shy on that. But because, you know, I've written for Doctor Who on the audios, and that's like, I mean, that's quite daunting, because these are the keys for a car you wanted to drive for a very, very long time. But because of the boundaries that were broken down by some of the novels in the 80s and the 90s, and that fans were starting to write Doctor Who, it was conceivable that you might get a crack at doing it. Mm. And you're creating your own new characters within that. But this was the dialogue's there, the image, you've got images in your head of the characters, I mean, not even in your head because they're on the printed page. So we kind of, it's a way of getting around that, not to make the adaptation restrictive or to put place those restrictions on yourself, I think. And that's a confidence issue, I think.
And also, presumably it requires a larger cast than the average Big Finish production as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other problem, and that affected a few decisions when we were going through it, because Jason kind of throws, he was directing as well as producing, through specific kind of, right, you can have this many actors, and you realise that the amount of actors you've been given doesn't cover the amount of characters. There's a lot of characters, and some quite important characters who only have small things to do, so you kind of have to, you're kind of juggling logistics of, right, I could get him to double up on that character and that character. And it made my decision to kind of cut the character of Kowalski lock, stock. Because I also thought he was a character who was almost too obvious for the audio medium because he was a narrator, and I didn't want to have a narrator as such. I mean, Luther does some narrating, but I didn't want to have, in the beginning, there was. And that's what I kind of almost thought Kowalski did. And as I was reading through it, I could see ways of making the story work without him. And similarly, I don't think it's any secret that we are working on Heart of Empire. I'm doing the adaptation at the moment. Again, that's a character that's had to go. And I mean, that could have been problematic because he's got some quite specific things to do in Heart of Empire. But because we didn't have him in the first one, I felt it was important to have that continuity for the fans who've not read the graphic novel but are fans of Big Finish and have come to it fresh, that they'll be wondering, who is this Kowalski guy? So I am taking a few more liberties, I'd say, in kind of making decisions which will service the audio and not necessarily service the source material.
When you were writing it, presumably, I mean, I've not written comics, but when a comics writer describes to the artist what they want in the frame, you know, I want a vista of Zeppelins, yada, yada, yada. Because you're translating a visual story to the audio medium, did you also put directions in for sound effects when you're writing, saying, I'd like to hear the sound of, you know?
Absolutely, and that's very important for the sound designers as well, not only for the actors to visualise it, but definitely for the sound designers to get that effect. And me and Jason, we had lots of discussions about how we were going to achieve some of the more esoteric sequences that Brian's put in, kind of more of the kind of the trippy stuff, shall we say. And the kind of the way Brian deals with time and, you know, events slowing down, speeding up. And we came up with the idea of doing audio bullet time, almost Matrix style, of chopping and changing and slowing things down and holding moments in time and then coming back to them. The sequence in question, really, that I think we tried that in was the assassination, where Arkwright, he leaps from the top of Westminster Abbey across to the cabinet rooms, and then we hold him there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, while other things are going on, and then he suddenly appears and comes through. Time speeds up, but we do have in that scene a slowing down of dialogue to almost stopping as Luther moves normally, and then it's very hard to describe and put it into words, but I think the best description was audio bullet time, just to try and get a little bit of a more stylized approach to it, to achieve some of those moments where when you've read Luther Rockhart, you go, what was that? And you go back and you read it again, you say, what was that? And I think we wanted to do that in the audio because there are sequences, whether by look or judgment, where you go, not quite sure what's going on there. And I think it was important to bring that across from the source material as well.
While you were writing it, did you have any idea who they'd be casting as Luther or Cromwell, for example?
We knew that David Tennant and Paul Darrow were going to be in it. Jason said to me, I've got Paul Darrow as Cromwell. That was the first piece of casting, because right. I think Jason had been talking to Paul for a long time, you know. Absolutely, something. There's some scenery to chew in only the way that Paul Darrow can, and I mean, he was magnificent. And the casting of David Tennant just was a dream, really. I mean, this was, you know, Doctor Who was but a twinkle in his eye at the time, I think.
And even Casanova.
Yeah, definitely. And he'd been doing a lot of work for Big Finish at the time. I first met David recording a Doctor Who, one of the Doctor Who Unbounds, and we got on. And he's so very kind of inclusive, and, you know, and he'll talk to anybody, and he remembers you. And it was a Big Finish Christmas party, and me and Jason, we were chatting about doing Luther Arkwright, and David was talking to us, and we kind of both looked at each other, me and Jason, and said, you know who could play Luther? And we both looked at David, and he went, what? We've got this thing we might... Well, I'm doing this for you. I'm doing Dalek Empire. I'm doing... Can I do any more for you? Like, yes, you can do this. And he was really up for it, very enthusiastic. And one of the things I'm very proud of is we had David Tennant screaming Rose before Russell T. Davis did.
Does Big Finish have any plans to adapt any other sort of classic British graphic novels, or just seeing how the next one goes first?
I don't think so. I think Luther Arkwright is very close to Jason's heart, which is why he went after the rights. And it would be interesting to say, do have a crack at something like V for Vendetta.
Yeah.
And take a different approach to the movie. A better approach. I quite like the movie. It was fun. But it would be interesting. And I know that I think because the 2000 ADs ended. Because I always thought it would be a great idea on the 2000 ADs to tackle some of the classic Judge Dredd stories, kind of Europe, Apocalypse Wars and Blockmania and The Cursed Earth.
Because Dirk Mads had done David Lort Died on BBC.
Yeah, and I think it might have been something about the license. I think Rebellion, I mean, don't quote me on this, but I think Rebellion wanted it in current continuity, which is why I think there was no Judge Anderson, because she was in a coma at the time. Okay. And that would have been a shame, because I think one of the problems of 2000 AD was, and it's no fault of anybody's, is that it was, you have an ongoing weekly fix in a visual format of Judge Dredd and Strong and other characters, and I think to really make them successful, it would have been had to be interpretations of the big Judge Dredd hitters. So I think that's kind of always the issues with graphic novels, is kind of how much does it serve the audience really in terms of doing audios. And I think Luther, because it's got such an interesting fan base, and Brian's got such an interesting fan base, and it's such an interesting rich story, it would be interesting to do something like V for Vendetta, and other things, or maybe go back and do something like Captain Britain, the classic Captain Britain's. Yeah. Kind of the mighty world of Marvel days. So I don't know. I mean, I think for the time being, Heart of Empire is, you know, it's on the go. And I'm quite, I mean, it's a different process this time, because it's such a different story. And it goes off in all sorts of wild directions. And Victoria Arkwright is actually an incredibly unlikable character at the beginning. She's horrible. And she doesn't want anything to do about her father, the legacy. And then things start happening, and she meets Harry Fairfax, and that's the joy, is kind of bringing, because I think one of the things that worked in the original was the relationship between Luther and Harry, and I think that works on not only in the original graphic novel but on audio, because of the performances of David and Jess Fielder, Jeremy James as he is, and I think they relished playing those scenes. I've written some fresh scenes at the beginning to do some scene setting for people who might not have heard the original, of things that are said. Harry talks about Luther's disappearance in kind of after Rose's funeral, but we don't actually see it, and I've put scenes of that at the very beginning as a kind of a prologue, and then walking through Highgate Cemetery. So those are some of the new directions I'm taking, and the liberties. But it's just such a, honest too big a word, I think, but kind of working on this material again, to have a second bite at it, and to be kind of playing with Brian Talbot's words and worlds and characters. I mean, it's, you know, it's good, basically.
The Adventures of Luther Arkwright is available to buy as a CD from all good shops, particularly those with the word Planet in their title, and also directly from Big Finish. The original Arkwright graphic novel and its sequel Heart of Empire are currently out of print, but due back in paperback shortly. However, they are available as a download and CD-ROM from Brian's website, who is currently touring the country with Alice in Sunderland, and can be found in Leeds, York and Manchester this weekend, and Aberdeen, Glasgow and Edinburgh the weekend after. If you'd like to win a copy of the audio adaptation of Luther Arkwright, signed by both Brian and Mark, you need to send me an email to the following address, backprojection@hotmail.com. That's backprojection. And tell me the name of Luther's friend, played by Jeremy James in the audio version, and also the code given to Luther's induction tape entries. The first 5 correct entries win. For links about all the above, and to download the podcast of tonight's show, please visit www.readyformyclosesup.blogspot.com. And I'm Ready for My Close-Up. We'll be back next week with an interview featuring Paul Cornell, whose latest episode of Doctor Who goes out on Saturday. See you next week.